From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Sam Raimi's Spider-Man film is out on video. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Marvel comic book artist Stan Lee. He'll tell us how he came to create Spider-Man, the geek who becomes a superhero. Lee introduced angst and neurosis into the superhero formula and revolutionized comics. Also, an advice columnist to the birds and bees. We hear from evolutionary biologist Olivia Judson, a.k.a. Dr. Tatiana. Her new book is Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Curb Your Enthusiasm, the Larry David Show on HBO, which completes its second season on Sunday. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The chief UN weapons inspector called today on Iraq to declare all its weapons of mass destruction. Hans Blix said that if Iraq continues to deny that it has such weapons, then any country that claims to have evidence to the contrary must provide it to the inspectors. Shortly after Blix spoke, the Pentagon announced that U.S. and British warplanes had bombed an Iraqi air defense site after Iraqi forces fired on coalition aircraft that were patrolling the southern no-fly zone. Blix will be flying to Baghdad on Monday. He said that inspections will probably resume on November 27th. The Senate has agreed to limit debate on legislation to create a new Department of Homeland Security. This clears the way for a final vote on the bill early next week. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The vote to prevent a filibuster of the Homeland Security legislation came despite growing concern among Democrats about several provisions in the bill. Maryland Senator Paul Sarbanes complained that the items were inserted during last-minute negotiations between lawmakers and the White House.
All of a sudden, they've manifested themselves in this legislation, provisions that were not in this bill before, dealing with unrelated extraneous matters.
They include provisions to extend liability protection for pharmaceutical companies and to make Texas A&M the likely site of a new research center on Homeland Security. Republicans argue that most of the provisions are justified and that tampering with the bill now will only delay creation of the new department. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
The Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad has claimed responsibility for an ambush that killed at least 12 Israelis and wounded 15 today in the West Bank city of Hebron. Palestinian gunmen attacked Jewish settlers as they left a site that's holy to both Jews and Muslims. The FBI has issued a strong warning about the possibility of terrorist attacks by al-Qaeda, but the administration has not changed the official threat level, saying there's little specific information about where an attack might occur. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The bulletin was issued to local law enforcement officials and placed on the website of the FBI's National Infrastructure Protection Center. It says that intelligence reports indicate possible terrorist operations against civilian targets by so-called sleeper cells already in the U.S. They might rely on conventional explosives carried by private planes or small watercraft. Administration officials were barraged with questions about the language of the bulletin, which indicates al-Qaeda may favor what it called spectacular attacks with mass casualties. Administration officials have tried to play down the warning. They say it's just one of a series of recent warnings in response to an audio tape message purported to be from Osama bin Laden. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow gained 37 points to close at 85.79. This is NPR News. President Bush sent congratulations today to the new head of China's Communist Party, the man who's in line to succeed President Jiang Zemin. Spokesman Scott McClellan said the Bush administration looks forward to working with Hu Jintao, who's now China's vice president. The Chinese Communist Party announced today that Hu Jintao has been chosen to lead it after a week of political meetings on the future of the ruling institution. Vice President Dick Cheney will confer with the new party leader during a planned visit in the spring. Thousands of Maoist rebels have attacked police posts in Nepal, leaving more than 100 rebels, police, and soldiers dead. The raids may scuttle efforts to bring the two sides to the negotiating table. Martha Ann Overland reports from New Delhi.
Late Thursday night, hundreds of rebels launched attacks on government positions in two remote areas of the country where the Maoists maintain strongholds. Officials report that the battles lasted well into the morning, ending when the army was able to send in reinforcements. State radio is reporting that the rebels used villagers as human shields, but the accounts are difficult to independently verify. The town of Jumla, where dozens of police as well as rebels died, is accessible only on foot or by air. The overnight raids came just hours after Nepal's deputy prime minister said he was willing to hold talks with rebels to end the six-year-old insurgency that is crippling the impoverished country. But after the attacks, the prospect of bringing both sides to the table looks increasingly dim. For NPR News, I'm Marthan Overland in New Delhi.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost a fraction to close at 1,411. For the week, the NASDAQ had gained 51 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
With great power comes great responsibility.
This is my gift.
Wow.
It is my curse.
Who are you?
Who am I? I'm Spider-Man.
That's Tobey Maguire from the film Spider-Man, which is now out on video. It's based on the Marvel comic book character co-created by my guest Stan Lee and artist Steve Ditko. Starting in the 1940s, Lee served as head writer, editorial and art director, publisher and chairman of Marvel Comics. He's now chairman emeritus of the company and is currently suing Marvel over a percentage of the profits from the Spider-Man franchise and the film, which he executive produced. Throughout his career in comics, Lee's superheroes were distinguished by their psychological complexity. They were burdened with self-doubt and existential angst. They include the Fantastic Four, X-Men, Doctor Strange, and the Incredible Hulk. Stan Lee's memoir, Excelsior, The Amazing Life of Stan Lee, is out in paperback. When we spoke this summer, I asked Stan Lee about the origins of Spider-Man, whether he first thought of creating a superhero who could crawl up walls or one that was a geeky teen.
Well, I think the geek part came first. I decided I wanted somebody who every one of the readers could identify with, because I think every teenager thinks of himself or herself as somewhat geekish at some time or other. Most teenagers are somewhat insecure and shy and inhibited and introverted. So I figured a hero like that would be very empathetic to the readers.
So how did the spider element come in?
Well, with every new superhero, you have to have a new superpower because, as I'm sure you're aware, the superpower is what makes them superheroes rather than regular heroes. And we, of course, specialized in superheroes. I had already done a book called The Fantastic Four, and in that book I had a girl who was invisible, a man who could stretch any part of his body, a fellow who could burst into flame and fly, and somebody who was one of the strongest people on Earth at the time. And I was figuring, or I was trying to figure, what other power can I give somebody? And I saw a fly crawling on a wall. Now, I've said this so often it might even be true. I can't even remember anymore. But I saw this fly crawling on a wall, and I said, gee, wouldn't it be something if a hero could stick to walls and move on them like an insect? And that's how it happened, and lo, a legend was born.
So, but why wasn't he Insect Man or
Spider-Man? As a matter of fact, he almost was. Because having decided that was the superpower I wanted to give him, I next had to come up with a name. So I began to think. Insect Man, Mosquito Man, Gnat Man. I mean, anything I could think of. None of them sounded right. I finally got to Spider-Man, and somehow it sounded dramatic. It sounded mysterious. So that was the name I chose.
Now, why do superheroes all wear these spandex costumes? The question of the ages.
That is a very interesting question. Remember I mentioned before Spider-Man I had done a book called The Fantastic Four. Well, that was the first of the so-called Marvel Universe characters. And I wanted The Fantastic Four to be as different from other books as Spider-Man was. So one of the things I decided was I would give none of those characters costumes. Because I always felt if I suddenly developed a superpower, I don't think the first thing I would do would be run to a costume store and say, quick, give me a mask and some spandex. So I just gave them regular clothes, and I published the issue. And we started to get a tremendous amount of fan mail, and most of the letters said something of this nature. Stan, we love the book. The Fantastic Four is great. Oh, man, are we excited about it. But if you don't give them costumes, we'll never buy another issue. Now, I don't know the reason for that. I have racked my brain. I have tried to research it. I don't know why. But it just seems that the people who like superheroes like to see their superheroes in costumes.
Well, let's talk about the Spider-Man movie. There are a lot of poses directly out of the comic strip in the movie, and that recreate Spider-Man, for instance, hanging upside down with his knees out. That's a classic silhouette for Spider-Man. And also swinging through the streets of New York with his arms straight outstretched.
Steve Ditko, the artist, did such a wonderful job of those shots in the beginning that he did of Spider-Man swinging and clinging to walls and hanging upside down. Most people who've read those early books still remember those shots.
Yeah, what do you think that the movie got right in terms of the visual aesthetics?
Oh, I think the movie got virtually everything right. It got the essence of Peter Parker, the shy young man who suddenly comes into his own once he gets the superpower. It got his ambivalence, his feeling that somehow the superpower he had gotten is as much a curse as a blessing. There was one little thing about the movie that I felt could have been better. I never cared for the mask that the Green Goblin had. I think that Willem Dafoe is such a fine actor, I would have loved to have seen his face when he was the Green Goblin. I would have loved to have seen his expression. Somehow the mask, which was solid and unchanging, it to me wasn't as dramatic as actually seeing his face would have been. But that is a small complaint, and I thought everything else was absolutely wonderful.
Now, we have to get into the controversy that fans found troubling, that Spider-Man's web powers were made organic. It was something that grew from his genetically altered spider bite, as opposed to something that, as you had written into the strip, something that he created as a burgeoning young scientist.
How about that? They dared tamper with my creation. Well, let me tell you, if I had done the movie, I would have tried to keep it that he created this little web shooter himself. I remember when Jim Cameron thought that he would do the Spider-Man movie a few years ago. He did an outline, a treatment for the movie, a very detailed one. It was more than 50 pages. And he sent it to me, and it was a wonderful story, but I noticed that he, too, made the web shooting organic. And I said to him, gee, why don't you keep it the way it was in the book? And he said, well, I think it would be hard to make an audience believe that somebody, some kid, could just create something like that himself. And then we talked about other things, and I went home and I thought about it, and I thought the way I would have done it would be, in the beginning, to show that Peter had always been, he was a science scholarship student. I mean, that was a given. He was a very bright student, and he was winning a scholarship in science. Now, the one thing he was always trying to do, if he ever went for a doctorate, this would be his doctorate thesis. He was trying to find something that could be shot out of a tube and stick to walls and stay, you know, whatever. This web was the thing he was trying to work on, but he never could get it right. However, once he was stung by that bitten by that radioactive spider, suddenly he knew how to do it. It not only increased his strength and gave him spider power, but the bite and the radioactivity, whatever, made him aware of how he could create that web shooter. Now, that's the way I would have done it. But after I thought about it a lot and after I saw the movie, I'm inclined to think that maybe Jim Cameron and Sam Raimi, who did such a wonderful job directing the movie, maybe they were right. Maybe somehow it's more dramatic to see him just do it the way he did organically, and it also saved them a lot of time because it would have taken quite a few extra minutes of screen time to show it the way I had just mentioned. So it may upset the fans, and I'm sorry it does, and I love them for their loyalty, but it really doesn't upset me.
Now, you grew up in New York during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So how hard hit was your family?
Oh, we were very hard. Well, my dad was just not a lucky man when it came to finance or to getting jobs. Unfortunately, most of my memories of him, he was unemployed and he spent most of his time reading the want ads. He had been a dress cutter, and I guess there were just no jobs for dress cutters in those days. And I always felt tremendous pity for him because it must be a terrible feeling to be a man and just not be bringing in the money that's needed for your family.
Did you feel that you had to rush through school to start work to help out the family? I know a lot of Depression kids felt that.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I worked while I was going to school. I had a lot of part-time jobs, yeah.
So how did you get your start in comics?
Accidentally. I heard there was a job open in a publishing company, and I thought, well, maybe they publish books or magazines. I didn't know that they published comics. I didn't know that that's where the job opening was, in the comic book department of this little company. And I took the job as an assistant. I did a little proofreading. I helped erase the pages once they were inked, and I ran errands and did some copy reading, and after a while they let me do a little writing, and then they let me do a little more writing, and that was really how it started.
And this was Timely.
Yeah, it was called Timely Comics at the time.
Now, radio was really big. Were you a radio fan?
Oh, yeah, I loved radio.
It's interesting because the wonderful thing about your writing was that it was so snappy. It seemed to speak to me of radio, and you loved lots of slogans and alliteration, the Green Goblin,
yeah,
and Doc Ock and Dr. Doom, and I remember something, some incantation. What was it Dr. Doom used to say? By the hoary host.
No, that was Dr. Strange.
No, I get the doctors confused.
We had a number of doctors. Dr. Strange was a magician. I called him the master of the mystic arts.
That's right.
And obviously he would cast spells and he would do magical things. Well, I couldn't have him say abracadabra when he wanted to do something. I felt I had to create little expressions for him, little incantations that he could utter. So I'd have him say things like, by the hoary hosts of Hoggoth, let though and such happen, or by the crimson rings of Sidorok, or I just made up any silly thing that sounded the way I thought it should sound. Funny thing about it was, in later years, I did a lot of college lecturing, and very often people in the audience during the questions and answer period would say, Stan, we've been making a study of the incantations of Dr. Strange, and my friends and I have come to the conclusion that you were very heavily influenced by the ancient Druid writings or by, and you know, they'd mention something very obscure that I had never heard of. But it's funny how people will always read more into what you write than you ever put in there.
Stan Lee's memoir of his career with Marvel Comics is Excelsior, The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. Spider-Man the film is now out on video. We'll hear more of my conversation with Stan Lee after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
Let's continue our interview with Stan Lee, who co-created the Marvel comic book superheroes Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, the X-Men, and the Fantastic Four. What people most remember about the Fantastic Four, I think, is that they were so dysfunctional. It's kind of like a bickering, dysfunctional superhero family.
Well, you're absolutely right. And again, I think that's one of the reasons that they were popular, because just like Spider-Man's Peter Parker being the kind of teenager that the readers could identify with, I think for the first time, the Fantastic Four was a group that readers could identify with. They were not dissimilar to their own families. See, I didn't have a girl, for example, who had no idea that the hero was really the man she loved was really a superhero. She knew who he was. In fact, she was engaged to him, and she was part of the team.
This is Sue Storm you're talking about, one of the Fantastic Four. She was Mr. Fantastic's girlfriend, the Invisible Girl.
Exactly. Mr. Fantastic, as he modestly called himself, it was his girlfriend.
I mean, it really was a soap opera.
It was.
Right?
It was. But you see, to me, every story should be done like a soap opera, because that's what people like. If you don't have the character's personal problems, if you don't have people who are having difficulty relating to other people, if you don't have characters with problems that seem unsolvable and you wonder how will they ever get out of this, then what have you got? You've just got a series of incidents, and you don't care about those, because if you don't care about the characters, you can't care about the story.
Now, the Fantastic Four was a big hit, and somewhere in this stretch of the 60s, you put out a series called Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos.
Yeah.
Very different from the Fantastic Four. And I believe that series started because of a bet. What was that all about?
What happened was we had been doing very well. We now had what we called the Marvel Universe. So one day, again, I was talking to my publisher, who's a great guy, but we often didn't agree on things. And he said, Stan, what is it that's making these books sell so well? You know, immodestly, I wanted to say it's because I'm writing most of them, but I didn't. But he said, I think it's the titles. I think they are great titles. I said, that has nothing to do with it. It's the style of the writing. And I mentioned what we just said. Even though they're superhero stories, I'm trying to treat them like soap operas where the characters' personal lives are important. He didn't see it. He said, no, I don't think that's it. I think it's the titles. So I said, okay, you know what I'm going to show you, what I'm going to do for you? I'll make you a bet. I'm going to put out a book with the worst title I can think of, and I'm going to put it out in a field, in a genre that nobody is interested in. And at that time, nobody wanted war stories. I mean, people were sick of them. They were sick of war. I said, I'm going to do a war book. And I thought and I thought and I came up with the title Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos, which is much too long a title.
Well, and doesn't alliterate.
That's right. It wasn't alliterative, and nobody knew what a howling commando was. So we did it, and luckily, sure enough, it sold. And he grudgingly admitted maybe I had a point there. But I forgot to mention one other thing. It was also a book that had the first ethnic group of heroes. In Sergeant Fury's platoon, we had a Jewish soldier named Izzy Cohen. We had a black soldier, an Italian soldier, a Scandinavian soldier. We even had a gay soldier. And this was in the middle 1960s. And I think it took a little courage to do it then. And everybody said to me, oh, the book won't sell in the South. It won't sell in the East. It won't sell in the West. It sold all over, proving that people are really more broad-minded and smarter than anybody gives them credit for.
So tell me about this gay character. What was the story with him?
The gay character?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, he was just one of the members of the platoon. His name was Percy Pinkerton. He was English. And he carried an umbrella. I mean, he also carried a gun, but he would use the umbrella also to confuse people. And I mean, I didn't play up the gay part, but somehow you could assume he was gay in reading the stories. But he was brave and nice and friendly, and everybody liked him, and he was one of the platoon, one of the guys.
A lot of kids who grew up in the Depression felt very insecure financially and chose very stable careers. Did you ever feel that this just is not the career for a grown-up and just not stable and financially secure enough for you?
Well, I think for the first 20 years, I felt this is definitely not the career for a grown-up. And very, very often, I wanted to leave, to quit. But I would get a raise, or I'd work with a new artist and get interested in what we were doing, or something would happen to make me decide to stay a little longer. But my biggest regret was, during those early years, nobody had any respect for what I was doing. Nobody cared about a fellow who wrote comic books. I mean, it just was the bottom of the cultural totem pole.
Did it make you nervous, though, and maybe accounts for the real drive that you seem to have had? I mean, you had a huge creative drive.
Yeah, I get. Well, you know what really made me that way, perhaps? It was my father. I used to just wish that poor man could find a job. And I was stupid. That's why I'm not a businessman. Instead of me wanting to maybe create comics for myself and for my own company, which I could have done, all I wanted was a steady job. To me, it seemed as if having a good job, a steady job, is the greatest success a person could attain. Only because my father never had one. And I think that's another reason that kept me at Marvel, or at what was then Timely, so long, because I felt at least I've got a job, you know? And I really should have left and tried to start a little something of my own, but, well, I didn't know.
Stanley, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
That's it. I'm just getting started.
Stanley's memoir is Excelsior. Spider-Man the movie is now out on video. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. Spins a web, sweet surprise. Catches thieves, just like flies. Look out! Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Daedalus Books, overstocks of books and CDs on the web at saleboks.com. or 1-800-395-2665 for a catalog. And Audi, the luxury car company with quattro all-wheel drive in every model line. Details at AudiUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Seduction in the Animal World. We talk with scientist Olivia Judson about her guidebook to the biology of sex. Judson writes in the persona of Dr. Tatiana, a sex columnist for creatures as varied as the African elephant and slime mold. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Curb Your Enthusiasm, starring Larry David, on HBO. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it, but very few of us know exactly how they do it. And that's where my guest, Olivia Judson, enters the picture. She's a biologist and journalist who specializes in the evolutionary biology of sex. Her articles have appeared in Science, Nature, The Economist, and other publications. Judson says that we don't know the most basic things about this most basic of functions. Think about it. Humans would say sex is copulation, but frogs and most fish would say it's the squirting of eggs and sperm during spawning. Then again, scorpions might tell you that sex is packets of sperm deposited on the ground for the female to sit on so they'll explode in her reproductive tract. To address the varied and colorful conflicts that arise in the process of reproducing, Olivia Judson has invented a helpful persona in her guidebook to the evolutionary biology of sex, Dr. Tatiana's sex advice to all creation.
Dear Dr. Tatiana, I'm a queen bee, and I'm worried. All my lovers leave their genitals inside me and then drop dead. Is this normal? Perplexed in Cloverhill. For your lovers, this is the way the world ends, with a bang, not a whimper. When a male honeybee reaches his climax, he explodes, his genitals ripped from his body with a loud snap. I can see why you find it unnerving. Why does it happen? Alas, Your Majesty, your lovers explode on purpose. By leaving their genitals inside you, they block you up. In doing so, each male hopes you will not be able to mate with another. In other words, his mutilated member is intended as the honeybee version of a chastity belt.
Olivia Judson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The queen bee's question really plunges one into the battle between the sexes right at the beginning of the book. Well, it's really a battle on all fronts.
Yes.
Every man and woman for himself and herself. Do you see this in the likely evolutionary scenario of the honeybee?
I do. I think that the honeybee is a very good example of the sorts of conflicts that arise. The problem is that if a female benefits from mating with more than one male, and in most species, we now know, although this is a recent finding, in most species it seems clear that females do benefit a great deal from mating with more than one male. This is a real problem for each of her lovers, because from her point of view, she benefits, she has more and healthier offspring. From his point of view, it's a catastrophe, because her mating with other males means that fewer of her offspring will be his. And in the case of the honeybee, it's particularly dramatic, because each male has, in the first place, a very small chance of mating at all. The fate of most male honeybees is to die virgins. And so those that do have, in fact, nothing to lose by exploding. And the advantage of exploding is that by leaving his member behind, he may be able to prevent the female from mating again. But it's a problem for other males, because obviously they would like to mate as well. And so you would expect to see that the queen does not want to be prevented from mating again, and that other males do not want to be prevented from mating with her. And so, sure enough, the queen is able to clean herself up if she is inclined to. And the males also have now evolved a structure on the tips of their phallus, which allows them to remove the detritus from a previous lover.
Like a scoop?
Yeah, kind of. It's very common. A lot of males have this feature.
This gets us into promiscuity among males and females in the animal world. And the cliche of human sexuality is that men are promiscuous and women are chaste. How does that play itself out in other species?
I think that's complete nonsense. It used to be thought that that was generally true throughout the animal kingdom, that males were philanderers and females were very virtuous and would resist mating and would never, you know, after they'd mated once, particularly in species that store sperm, they would have enough sperm for their whole lives, and that would be that. They would not be interested in sex anymore. Females are, in general, however, much, much more promiscuous than they need to be if fertilizing their eggs were the only aim. And that discovery was not made until the 1980s. And then it wasn't even realized. So it was realized in the 1980s that females were more promiscuous than people thought. And then it was realized that, in fact, promiscuous females benefit from promiscuity, benefit from their behavior. In other words, promiscuous females tend to have more and healthier offspring in pretty much every species that I could find data for.
And what's the correlation there? Why would that be so?
Well, There's a large industry now in the last, even 3 or 4 years. This has been something that scientists have started looking at because it's been impossible to avoid anymore this horrible truth that females gain from promiscuity. And I think that there are a number of possible reasons. There is no single explanation, but there are all sorts of possible reasons, varying from the idea that females are trying to get higher quality mates, that they meet one guy and they have sex with him just to make sure their eggs are fertilized, and then they meet a better guy, so they have sex with him too. That's one idea. Another idea is that having sex with different males allows them to have more help. There are some very obvious cases where this is true. In the bronze-winged jacana, which is a water bird that lives in India, the females run a harem where each female will try to have several males to herself. And the males do all of the work of sitting on eggs and feeding the chicks and building the nests, and the female just sort of, you know, has a grand old time.
In other species, do females only mate with males bearing gifts, like the proverbial box of chocolates?
It's very common. It's not always necessary, but it's very common, particularly in insects, and it can be extraordinarily expensive for the male. To produce gifts, males in most species obviously can't just go down the street and buy whatever they think is appropriate. They have evolved to produce gifts of various sorts. For example, they may hunt and bring the female something that they've caught to show that they're good at hunting, or just, you know, to please her. They may secrete something to give her. For example, in many butterflies, the male will secrete a large gift. And these can be very expensive. In the green-veined butterfly, it's 15% of his body weight. And basically, a male can only do this once. Each subsequent gift will be smaller. And females prefer males with large gifts. So in this species, virgins have an advantage.
Olivia Judson's book is Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now with evolutionary biologist and journalist Olivia Judson. One of my favorite letters is from an iguana in your book, and it goes like this: Dear Dr. Tatiana, I'm a marine iguana, and I'm appalled by the behavior of young iguanas today. I keep encountering groups of youths masturbating at me. It's revolting. I'm sure they didn't dare act this way in Darwin's time. How can I make them stop? Disgusted in the Galapagos. Now, I suppose masturbating serves some purpose, at least as far as iguanas go. What would that be?
Well, the iguana story is very curious. It turns out that these marine iguanas, which live in the Galapagos, have a problem. Young males have a problem, which is that females whether they prefer to mate with big males or not, usually do mate with big males because the big males are able to push the little males off. And so you don't have much time if you're a young male iguana. And it turns out that a little bit of masturbation to get yourself ready for sex decreases the length of time you need to complete copulation before. So this reduces the chance that you will be interrupted. As far as I know, no other species masturbates in order to reduce the chance of being interrupted.
Now, one theme of your book is the collision of the sexes, which, being so intense in so many species, sometimes generates horrific outcomes, such as rape and cannibalism. And I do like how your first chapter in this category starts, rule number one, never get eaten during foreplay. what evolutionary purpose does the violence in sex, then, among many species serve?
Well, cannibalism is a particularly curious example. Everybody knows that the praying mantis has a tendency to munch on her lover. But what everybody doesn't know is that quite often this happens even before he's had a chance to mate. From his point of view, this is a fiasco. Obviously, if he's dead, he cannot pass on any genes. And it's not just the praying mantis who is guilty of this. It's been reported in cannibalism of this kind, has been reported in spiders, more than 80 species. It's also been reported particularly graphically in the in some predaceous midges, where the female plunges her proboscis into the male's head and her spittle turns his innards to soup. So from the male's point of view, this is being cannibalized is incredibly bad news, particularly if it happens before sex. If it happens during sex, he may still have a chance. He may be able to fertilize some eggs. And if it happens after sex, it may also not be too bad. It depends on his particular situation. For example, the Australian redback spider is the only known species where the male actually would like to be cannibalized, and he jumps into the female's jaws and attempts to persuade her to eat him. All the while she is eating, he is copulating, because in spiders, the male's genitalia are modified mouthparts, and so she munches on his belly, and he reaches under and fits his mouthparts into the appropriate places on her belly. But this is very unusual, and it turns out that the reason that he doesn't mind being cannibalized, in fact, invites it, is that males who are being eaten are allowed to copulate for longer, and therefore they fertilize a higher proportion of eggs. Males who are rejected will be rejected very quickly, and therefore will not actually be able to fertilize many eggs at all. But for most males, they do not wish to be eaten, because being eaten, first of all, precludes reproducing with a given female, and it also obviously precludes reproducing again. But from the female's point of view, it may not necessarily be that bad. At first glance, it appears that for a female to eat a male before sex is idiotic. But in fact, if a female is likely to meet many males during the course of her life, as indeed in many spiders she will do, then it doesn't matter if she eats most of them. As long as she doesn't remain a virgin, she's okay. And so sometimes it's not going to be too bad, and it may even occasionally be to her advantage.
Now here's a provocative quote from your book. True monogamy is one of the most deviant behaviors in biology. So how rare is rare?
It seems to be pretty rare. I combed the literature for examples, proven examples of monogamy, and they are very, very scarce. And I think that the reason is that it's rarely in anybody's advantage to be monogamous, if you are discussing monogamy purely in terms of how many offspring you'll produce, which is how success is measured in evolutionary terms. Monogamy is rarely advantageous for either sex, and so the conditions under which it evolves are peculiar and unusual.
There are some species, though, that do mate for life. You cite vultures.
The black vulture is one of my favorite examples. The black vulture does appear, as far as we know at the moment, it does appear to be monogamous. They have an interesting social system. They nest in pairs and on territories, quite large territories. But it's not simply a lack of opportunity thing, because black vultures are dependent on carcasses, and many vultures will convene at a single carcass. And so there are certainly opportunities for meeting other vultures and having a bit on the side. But it turns out that the black vultures are, well, prudish. They don't like to see sexual behavior in public. And if an inexperienced black vulture attempts to seduce somebody in public, everybody will attack him or her. And so this appears to reinforce the tendency for monogamous behavior. But there are other species that seem to be monogamous. My guess is that many species of shrimp may turn out to be monogamous. There are certainly quite a few that live in stable pairs, but shrimp are less studied than birds, and so we don't know nearly so much about them.
Can we talk about homosexuality then? If a majority of species do break down to male and female, what does evolutionary biology, how does it inform us on the question of human sexuality and homosexuality among our species?
Well, it's often said, particularly among social conservatives, for example, that homosexuality is unnatural, that it occurs only in humans, and it is some weird deviant behavior. There are two things that I'd like to say about that. The first is that whether it's natural or not is irrelevant. because I could find examples of all sorts of behavior that people would find abhorrent. For example, incest is very common in many organisms, but humans believe that close brother-sister incest is a bad idea. So whether it is natural or not is irrelevant. However, it turns out that, in fact, homosexual behavior is very common in the animal world, much more common than people have thought, and the range is extraordinary. The reason that many people assume that homosexuality cannot be something that occurs in nature is because homosexuals, particularly in the West now, homosexuals tend not to have children, and therefore any genes for homosexuality should disappear very quickly. Well, in other organisms, we know almost nothing about the extent to which homosexual behavior is exclusive. Many individuals engage in bisexual behavior, but I would, for the sake of argument, you can say, well, if the behavior is exclusive, so homosexuals never reproduce, and it is fairly common, so you can't just dismiss it as a fluke, then is there any way that the genes could be maintained in the population? And I think that there are ways that they can be maintained. For example, if a gene that leads to homosexuality in one sex leads to very great reproductive success in the other, then you would expect to see a certain proportion of individuals who are homosexual throughout their lives.
Well, one of the standard arguments against human homosexuality, at least a biological one, runs that if it doesn't lead to reproduction, how can it be a genetic trait? But in this case, it leads to reproduction of others. So
that's
you're
right.
Lending a helping hand.
Not necessarily lending a helping hand. It may be that the gene itself is just very beneficial when it is manifested in one sex. It's certainly true that genes are expressed differently in the different sexes very often. And in that case, you might expect to see that there are some genes that produce homosexuality in one sex, but produce some very beneficial trait in the other. A trait that leads to much greater reproductive success, either very great fecundity or very good looks, or, I mean, this is speculation, we don't know for sure, but that would be one mechanism by which genes for exclusive homosexuality could be maintained.
Well, I have to say a lot of the information in the book makes human sex quite pallid in comparison. Did you come away with your own conclusions about deviancy or any species you particularly envy?
Well, it certainly broadened my horizons. I think that that I would like to be reincarnated as a number of species. I think, for example, it would be fascinating to be a dolphin for all sorts of reasons, but particularly because they seem to have such amazing sex drive. I think that would be fascinating. But I think that that in general, I mean, human sex may be dull, and in many respects it is, but basically I'm pretty glad to be human.
Olivia Judson, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Olivia Judson's book is Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. Coming up, a review of Larry David's series on HBO. This is Fresh Air. This weekend, the Larry David series Curb Your Enthusiasm concludes its second season on HBO. TV critic David Bianculli has absolutely no complaints, not about the show and not even about how few episodes it presents each year.
When Seinfeld was the most popular show on television, and still going strong, Larry David walked away from it. He had created the show with Jerry Seinfeld, and was responsible for a lot of the show's tone and humor, but thought enough was enough. Eventually, Seinfeld agreed with him and ended the series while it was still the most popular comedy on TV. For that final episode, David returned to write the script. Then everybody went their separate ways. The supporting cast members of Seinfeld, Jason Alexander, Michael Richards, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, went on to star in their own sitcoms. All of them flopped. Seinfeld retired his old comedy act and just released a new movie called Comedian. It's a documentary showing his return to the stand-up stage, writing and trying out new material while agonizing over every move. It's a wonderful film. It's also familiar if you've been following the post-Seinfeld career of Larry David. What David did after Seinfeld was go to HBO and propose a comedy special in which the subject would be him returning to the stand-up stage, something he hadn't done since his days as an angry young comic on the cast of the ABC late-night show Fridays. Michael Richards, by the way, was on that show, too. As always with David, his TV vehicle would have a twist. With Seinfeld, it was a show about doing nothing. With his special, which he called Curb Your Enthusiasm, it would be a combination documentary and stand-up act. The first part would show David pitching the special to HBO, planning and rehearsing it, and going about his everyday life. The second part would be the act itself. Except that in both parts, Larry David couldn't play it straight. For the behind-the-scenes segments, he cast actors to play his manager, his wife, and the HBO executives, and improvised a loose approximation of his everyday reality. And he liked that part of the special so much, he didn't even include the stand-up part. The whole special was a build-up to him walking out on stage, but when he got there, the credits rolled. HBO and David were so happy with the result, they turned the special into a series. Larry would play himself, Cheryl Hines would play his wife, and Jeff Garlin his manager. Real-life friends like Richard Lewis and Ted Danson would pop in, playing usually unflattering versions of themselves. And the trick this time was that each show would be carefully outlined but not scripted, so the actors could improvise their way through each scene. There were 10 episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm last year. This season, the 10th and final one of the year arrives Sunday and will leave me hungry for more. When the first episode of the series was shown, I called it the best sitcom since Seinfeld. Since then, it's only gotten better. On Curb, Larry David is like John Cleese's character of Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers. Everything around him seems to irritate him, or escalate into irritating someone else. David has gotten so good at this by now that even with guest stars in small roles, he hits home runs with his conversational, confrontational, spur-of-the-moment dialogue. In one recent episode, Larry gets into trouble by losing the jacket he's supposed to be wearing in every scene of a Martin Scorsese film. He tracks down the store that made the jacket and finds a perfect replacement, the last one. Happy ending? Not on this show. Larry decides to keep shopping a little more and checks out a sweater on sale. The salesman, played by Jason Sklar, is eager to help, but not for very long. Here's how the scene and the sweater unfolds. And remember, except for those broad outlines, it's being made up on the fly.
I like, what is this? Oh, this is an extra large. Let me see, it might not fit.
It's a great sweater, too.
Yeah, way too big. Is that it? Do you not have any more?
No, it only comes in that size. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, I'll fold that up for you and we can get you rung up over there.
That's okay, I got it.
No, I can take care of it.
No problem.
Actually, I kind of need to take care of it. We have a very specific way that we fold things here, so I'll take care of it, okay?
Yeah, it's not that complicated. I can do it.
It's not that complicated. Actually, it is kind of a little complicated.
This is complicated?
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated. There's a specific way that we need to, can you let go? Okay, thank you. You're stretching it out now. It's not a scoop neck. It's actually a V-neck. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
I got it.
All right, well,
okay?
I'm sorry for trying to help you out.
Yeah, well, you weren't helping me out. You weren't helping me out. You're actually stretching out.
Oh, boy, look what you did. Boy, you really got it down.
Yeah, I did get it down.
Oh, I never could have done that.
Okay,
that's so hard to do.
Actually, I'm going to ask you to leave. I don't need to be insulted in my own store. I'm going to ask you to leave, okay? Thanks a lot.
I'll just take the jacket.
No, you know what? Actually, I don't think you're going to take the jacket, okay? Have a nice day.
It's a great scene, and it just sounds different from most comedy dialogue. On Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David is playing with the old Seinfeld sensibility. Instead of double dipping, he does a show about double tipping, but in a way that's fresh. Doing so few shows is another way of keeping it fresh. And if you think that's not enough, remind yourself that when John Cleese made Fawlty Towers for the BBC back in the 70s, he only made six. Then 2 years later, he went back and made six more, and that was it. A generation later, we're still treasuring Fawlty Towers. And a generation from now, I suspect, we'll still be treasuring Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Curb my enthusiasm? Sorry, can't do it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Jazz pianist and composer Sir Roland Hanna died this week at the age of 70. In 1985, the New York Times described him as being as much at home in turn-of-the-century ragtime as he is in the works of John Coltrane. Hanna worked with Benny Goodman, Coleman Hawkins, and with the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Jazz Orchestra. He also led his own groups and taught for years at music schools in New York. In 1960, he played on this version of Take the A-Train with Charles Mingus, Roland Hanna on piano. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by WorldCom. An update on management and policy is available at worldcom.com/update. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Parachute Infantry, an American paratrooper's memoir of D-Day and the fall of the Third Reich, by David Kenyon Webster, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet two of the Funk Brothers, the musicians who helped create the Motown sound. They're the subject of the new documentary, Standing in the Shadows of Motown. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Please don't.